Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. My name is Christine Wormuth. I'm a senior fellow here in the International Security Program at CSIS and have spent the last several years working certainly a lot of the time on National Guard and Reserve issues. So I'm very, very pleased to welcome you all here and to see everyone and to introduce Lieutenant General Clyde Vaughn, who is Director of the Army National Guard, who I think many of you already know. I just wanted to give General Vaughn a quick introduction. As you might imagine, as Director of the Army National Guard, he is essentially involved with everything from soup to nuts for the Army Guard, the formulation, development, implementation of all of the plans and policies and programs for the Army National Guard, which is over 350,000 soldiers strong these days. General Vaughn has very deep roots in Missouri, and as he was telling me, shares an alma mater with General Conway, which is somewhat unusual. He's a graduate of Southeast Missouri State College, Shippensburg University, and the Army War College. He was commissioned in 1974 and has served in a wide variety of positions in the Army National Guard, both as a traditional guardsman, but also as on active duty. In addition to spending a lot of his career in positions in Central and South America, more recently, General Vaughn has had general officer assignments in the Army G3 as, for me, certainly as someone who's very interested in Homeland Security, notably as the Deputy Director of DOMS, which is no longer around in its the form that we all knew and love, but the function's still there, and then served as Deputy Director of the Army National Guard and most recently as Assistant to the Chairman for Guard Matters and then, of course, for the last 2 years as the Director of the Army Guard. So I think one thing you have here in front of you is a general officer who, A, is not only deeply familiar with the homeland defense and homeland security civil support challenges that the Army National Guard is so important to, but also someone who has been in on the ground floor and has been tangling with and wrestling with the issues of the transition of the Guard and Reserve from a strategic reserve to part of the operational force for the last 4 years. I mean, this is someone who's really seen it at its inception and has dealt with all of the issues as they've gone forward. So with that as a background, I know I'm looking forward to having General Vaughn talk with us today about the Army National Guard's priorities, the challenges that the Guard is facing, and the path for the future. So General Vaughn's going to walk you through, I think, some slides with a discussion of his priorities, and then we'll open the floor to questions, and I hope have a very good discussion about some of these key issues. So with that, over to you, General Vaughn.
Thanks, Christine. I do have some slides, and I'll run through them just real quick, just as a background for maybe some discussion, and then get to get one slide in particular that really has to do probably with a lot of the thoughts and the questions that are around as far as the transition from a strategic to operational reserve, whatever that means, and I know there's lots of questions around that. Thanks for your great service over here. So I was talking to Christine about our university, the one that Jim Conway and I come from, you know, come up every year, and they'll be up here next week. I'll come over on Thursday night and say hi to some of the very best and brightest in that university, and they treasure very deeply the relationship with CSIS, and I can't Eric Randall owes me big time bucks for being over here and being in this program. I was never smart enough to have anything like this, you know, fall on my lap. You couldn't, you know, if somebody flew over and dropped $100 bills all day long, it couldn't be better for the Randall family to be here and be associated with the kind of folks that are here. Okay, having said all that, like I say, I want to, and Mr. Former Secretary Dubois, cut me some slack on a lot of this stuff. He and I did some serious snug work together on a lot of this stuff, and he'll have to laugh, you know, along with us at some of these pieces, but certainly saw it formulate. Let me hustle through here real quick. No secret, you know, to all of you. They give me a slide deck, and you all have got this down black and white. It's not a 101, you know, session, but you know, obviously, the peace with the governors that make us so very strong. We tell folks don't look over the fact that we are a congressional force. You know, if you look at that Constitution, what it really means, you'll find that the AC force is driven, you know, by the administration, and the other side, you know, the guard, especially the militias, dated all the way back to the colonies, is driven by that special relationship with Congress, and we're a congressional organization. I mean, when you look at it, our roots and the fact that we've done what we've done over all these years lays just exactly in that. and the power base that goes from those folks that are in every district, every armory. We say that the Guard is not just in the communities, it is the community. And a lot of people fail to realize that, and they look up too late, and they realize that, you know, what you're doing is taking apart something that's very integral, you know, to our basic fundamental processes here in the United States when you challenge this, the footing that the Guard stands on. That was my paid political announcement. And then this is a good slide as far as a long discussion set. And I'll talk briefly about each one of these in terms of growth. You know, there may be a myth out there that we're having a lot of trouble today in recruiting. It's not so in the Guard. We're recruiting youngsters at a rate that has never been seen. And our quality is the best that it's ever been. Now, we've got some real advantages with the way we recruit the community-based defense force that we are, the largest in the whole country. We put in place and changed a culture, a system, changed the whole system in such a manner that we took advantage of the decentralized nature of our force and the fact that all those folks are out there, those soldiers, you know, in the communities, and we've incentivized those. And it's a long story, I guess, and maybe it's a little bit complex in the nature of how we did this. But folks are starting to figure out just exactly what we did, and when they really look closely at it, we did something that's really remarkable, is we changed the culture of a major organization. And by the way, I studied under Jim Collins some, you know, and read all the books and all the things that they say is going to happen in major organizations when you try to change them, and the resistance to change, even in our own organization, to change it for the better is exactly right. There's people out there in the corporate world have had this figured out for a long, long time. And so we just took a chapter out of what he had written and put it down and made it happen. But anyway, today, and I'll show you a slide in a minute, we're in magnificent shape in strength. We talk about increasing individual readiness and the way we're going to do that. With the in strength increase in the Guard, at the same time, we were faced with something called a force structure and strength imbalance, where we had natural built-in unreadiness in our formations. That's the way that we found ourselves at the start of the conflict. And so we had to cut a lot of force structure out to get down close to what our in strength is. At the same time, we've got the recruiting machine, as you know, that's going wide open, and our in strength is now up over our force structure. Now, the next thing we've got built in our organizations, and it dates way back to our heritage, and our heritage being that you trained the soldiers in your units. And it wasn't until 1963 in the Rep 63 program that we actually put our basic trainee soldiers into the federal system and trained to the same standards. But as a consequence of all that, and a lot of people have failed to understand this over all the years, the training pipeline is embedded in our units. And so a soldier that's been recruited, awaiting training, or a soldier that is training is counted against our force structure and in strength up against that unit. So when you look at a unit that's 100% fully manned, womaned up, you know, it's got everybody there, the problem is not all of them have been trained. And so we're going through the process today of fixing that. And we've got everything. It's taken us 2.5 years to get to this point, and a lot of folks haven't realized what we've been up to. But we're going to have, within 4 years, we will have a P1 force all the time. We'll be as high a ready force in the United States of America as you can be. And I can explain that to you, you know, if you really want to get into that. And it's not a brag, right, Mr. Secretary? We're not bragging about it. It's just a matter of fact what we did, and we're very proud of it. The stability programs, pre-mob train validation, I know that, you know, all of you have seen And a lot of the work that's going on, pre-mob versus post-mob, and that's a great question. You know, we can really get into that deeply and what that pretends for readiness and for the way the United States of America goes to war. But that's a big deal, pre-post-mob training. And the movement of resources to make that happen for the nation is huge. Equipment procurement reset. I've got to tell you, we have made enormous progress. I mean, you know, We've railed against the equipment readiness and conditions in the Guard for some time. And where I sit now, we're starting to see the fruits of that come about. The Army has done remarkable things in helping us fix this. It's probably time to start giving some folks some credit on that, and I can talk in detail, but we're making progress along those lines. Full-time support, of course, there's two bookends on readiness. One's equipment on this end, and one's full-time support on the southern end. And if you want to crank up the readiness of the Guard or Reserve, then you got to put, you know, you got to put the training resources against it, you know, in the middle. And I can tell you that we're good to going back to probably 48 and 15, you know, when the time comes, and all of your experts in here, so you know what I'm saying. But as long as there's a war, we're good to keep this thing cranked up, you know, real high too. But what we're not trying to do is build a base budget so high and create a condition of readiness for a second standing army and be competition up against the active army. We're not about that. We're about having this big, magnificent force set all the way across the nation that gets the full support of the entire country up against it and use it when it's ready to go, but use it and we know what we got, not look around and it's something that's not ready, you know, at the level that you would hope it would be. So I'll be glad to talk to each one of those Okay, well, I won't attempt to go back and make that bigger because I'll, you know, the strength, again, nearly 3,000 communities, largest of all the community-based defense forces, and probably the most tightly knitted into the communities. You see a number over there today, 356,212. You know, our authorized and appropriated strength for some time has been 350,000. With growth in the Army, it slipped up to 351.3. We've been told, you know, 408. We've been told by OSD to take that to 358,000 this year, and that Army would find the funds to pay for that. We ought to grow this thing as far as we can grow it right now. And part and parcel of our success, all of our successes, we're also recruiting for the Army in something called Active First, and I can talk to that if you want to discuss that a little bit too. This is a slide I talked to you about a few minutes ago. This is what we've done in force structure. The hollow piece that I described is that between yellow and the line, and you can see it's crossed. It's crossed now on the other end at exactly the point that we are now. And so everything that we build now is true readiness. We took the hollowness out of the force, you know, while this conflict was going on, a tremendous amount of turbulence in our force. And what we have worked closely with the Army and my buddy Dick Formica and the folks sitting over here in the chairs is that we don't want to change any more force structure. The deal about the Guard is and the Reserve is if you don't change the formations too rapidly, then you will get good readiness because, you know, the folks over a period of time will get there. But if you keep changing it, I mean, you really tear readiness up in our force. So we've got to sit down on this thing now and stop the movement, and we've made a massive amount of transition here in the last 3 years. A couple of discussion points, maybe. The pieces on the top as far as the stability of the program, pieces underneath that as far as some of the things that we do in this recruiting, retaining, and holding on to soldiers. We have a great marketing program. I don't know how many of you are sports fans or NASCAR fans, but we see holistically the entire spectrum out there that we're trying to recruit. A lot of folks say, well, why are you in the fishing business? You know, we're in the fishing business. I mean, if you're a bass fisherman, everybody would know that because one of the icons of sport, Forrestal Wood out of Flippin, Arkansas, is right up there displaying all the National Guard wares. And you say, well, you know, I don't watch it. Well, right. But you know who does on Saturday and Sunday mornings? Mom and dads and grandpas and grandmas with her kids. And so it's an influence thing of trying to help them do what's right for the environment, you know, and some teaching pieces. And we really like the program. So we influence on this end. We also do this in something called Youth Challenge. And I think maybe some of you were at that the other day. That's giving back to the nation. And if those youngsters who are left behind, disadvantaged, falling off by the wayside, if they join the service, and there's no commitment to have to join the Guard, but if they do, that's a win for the nation. So we rescued a lot of folks out there. And then we have the folks in the middle. We run an enormous, what's called a GED Plus program, enormous, at Little Rock, at the Professional Education Center. And we're trying to grow that up to 10,000 people, soldiers a year. We get them their GED. We take them into the Guard, swear them in. We've got statutory authority to hold them for 1 year, but we've got to get their GED. We're averaging 94% in graduation right now. It's a magnificent program. And I'll tell you the next piece. We're going to run a high school program across the nation. We're after, when the bonuses go away, we're after how do we secure this force, this manpower force for the nation, when the money dries up. Looking out here, it's going to dry up at some time. We can't afford to pay these kind of bonuses year after year after year. So we're going after some folks that are going to have that loyalty to back to the Guard, and we're going to secure a large number of the recruits for the Guard. Now, the other things we do, you know, NASCAR's up there big time. Dale Jr., biggest name in sports outside is Tiger Woods, drives our car, and he does it because he wants to. He and his owner, who is a phenomenal businessman named Rick Hendrick, had looked out there and said, you know, the Guard has more outreach and more touch, represents the exact kind of things. Anybody could have come along, probably put more money into it and run that car. They come after us to run that car. A number of programs. Some of you have seen the, if you went to the show between Thanksgiving and Christmas sometime, and why, you know, it's when all the college students are home, right? And it's when everybody comes home, they go to the movies. My recruiter come to me one time and said, sir, you know, there are 7 segments right before a movie starts, 30 seconds apiece. Last couple of years, we bought a couple of those and done a real good feel-good advertisement, you know, thump, thump, thump on helicopters and all that music in the background. The young man says it's the DNA of America, you know, and everybody got crocodile tears and goosebumps and all that. So he comes to me and says, I got a neat idea. And this guy back here, Rich Gazzetta, also was in the background, but he didn't want me to hit him, so he let Jones, you know, talk about it first. He said, what we really want to do is create something that goes in before the show, and they don't know whether it's a song or a movie or an advertisement. And we want to play off the Army values, you know, and we want to, this is all about being warriors now. It's all about bringing goodness to the states and to the governors and doing those kind of things. So I said, okay, what do you got in mind? He said, I want to go after a rock band named Three Doors Down. I said, who are Three Doors Down? He said, well, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Jones said, I've expected you to come at me with a country western man. He said, if you ask every kid in the nation who Three Doors Down was, he said, we're not recruiting people as old as you. We're recruiting youngsters. We was right. So they did this production, and anybody see it? Okay, you know what it amounts to. One of the top rock songs in the country right now, of all things. And this thing, we put on 39,000 screens and bought all 7 segments during that period of time. Now, the funny part about this is I go in about 2 weeks after this thing had debuted, and I'm in there with Secretary Guerin and the small group around his table, and he says, Clyde, what did you do? I said, well, I don't know, sir. What are you talking about? He said, my girl. He said, I've been after her to join the service for some time. She went to the show the other night, come home and said, Dad, I'm going to join the National Guard. Well, I said, funny you should ask, and so I put it on and showed it to him. Marketing program is second to none. We have aimed it right at different levels. Influence down here, disadvantage left out. Big time, it's all about warriors. We got onto the warrior thing a long time ago. As soon as the conflict started, we stopped the piece about, you know, this is about education, bonuses, and all that. And everybody knows that they're going. The thing that's really helped us is the pride, you know, in this mission that they've taken on, and the way they've been brought back into the communities, to the receptions, public receptions, and the warm outpouring. It's overwhelming what it's done. So there's a great deal of patriotism back there, and we're playing on all that, and our marketing programs are probably second to none. That's a neat slide. At least over in the hill, they get that pretty quick. That's the hook slide. The low point, the bathtub, the very bottom of that was June of 05, right before the QDR. And, you know, we turned that around. Great deal of pride that will last for a long, long time based on what we did right here. That's called changing an entire organization and getting lined up on the football and coming off of it. I remind you, it hadn't stopped yet. We just had the best February of all time. And March is traditionally about the best month we ever had. So look out what happens this month. We think we can go to 358 with active first on the back end. We're actually going to hold a couple thousand soldiers that are going to go on to active duty. So is 360 the right number, 361.5 or so this year? Congress has turned around and given us an additional percent to 3%. And there's some that were asking us if it needs to be 5% over. And you know the problem with that is that's an authorization, not appropriation. But, you know, the issue here is, you know, what does it take, you know, to keep this force together right now? And right now we're the game in town because we've got it going and folks are joining our ranks. Okay, this is a slide I really want to talk about. We started 2.5 years ago with this, back before anybody had really talked much about being an operational reserve. Brought all the tags together, all 54 of them, and said we're going to line everybody up on this and get after it. And here's the things we got to do. Now, I got to tell you, being an operational reserve means a lot of things to a lot of different people, and it depends on who you're talking to. They all see it different ways. To me at that particular time, I was concerned about the recurring access to our formations by the Army on some kind of a consistent basis at a high level of readiness because there was a problem coming. Now, in no order, and this is an old, old slide, and these are actual, when you look at it, there are programs embedded in all these things, and they were the precursors. They were the floor on which we stood to make a lot of the changes happen. So are they all actually the right azimuths to get you an operational reserve? I don't know, but I can tell you from a Guard perspective, I can tell you the ones that we had to do and why. First one is this. Whoops, let me get this up here. The first one right here, accessible. Accessible to me at the time this slide was made was way back beyond the Secretary of Defense 12-month mobilization policy. Now, the funny little story is that we've been mobilizing people for over 4 years, and most of them had gone for 13, 14, 15, 18 months. The policy was 24 months cumulative. And I thought that everybody was praying probably for this thing to be over and us not have to face the reality of going back to the force again. Because if you go back to a Guard or Reserve soldier that's been gone for 18 months, and you say, oh, by the way, you know, 2.5 years later, not six or not five, maybe 3 years later, that you're going to go again for another 18 months, you can't hold that force together. And you can't expect the nation's employers to hold that force together either. Because in our view, and what we've done is inefficiently used that force. If you were going to get 24 months cumulative, then you ought to get two tours out of these folks. Or if you were going to get two tours, they'd have to equal 12 months apiece and add up to 24 months unless somebody changed the policy. The bigger item for us is that because we attrit about 18% a year, we're a big organization, about 60,000, you know, that we lose a year, we take in 60,000, 65,000. Doesn't take you too many pieces of paper to figure out that about every 5 years the force turns over except for the leadership. And so if you put all that together and say, let's see, who have I got to really worry about? You got to worry about the folks in the middle, the junior leaders. Okay? So if you can find a way to keep the junior leaders with you and you can put an efficient system together that takes them 12 months at a time, you can crank out 65,000 Guard soldiers a year forever. Now, no one's exactly that efficient. We had a little problem because we were up close to 100,000 mobilized, you know, when the real surge was on, you know, in 05. So we had to get this back to a flatline situation. Accessibility to us meant the 12-month mobilization policy and the changes in pre-MOB and post-MOB that had to be made that would be able for us to be able to continue to regenerate this force endlessly as the Army needed it. That's what it meant. And embedded in that is pre-mob training, big time. The organization piece, I talked to you briefly. We had to cut out, you know, all of the overstructure piece of that the best we could and get back to organizations that the Army really required on the battlefield at this particular time, and we did that. Strong, I talked you through the foundation on what we all stand on, which is the personnel piece, and we did that. The train piece goes back to the accessible and it's the pre-mob item. And it's such a big item. You're talking about billions of dollars over a long period of time, hundreds of millions of dollars that have to move from the right-hand side of mob to the left-hand side of mob. It also gets you back to where you're holding accountable those commanders and senior non-commissioned officers in your ranks to prepare people to go to war and not have to do that all post-mobilization, which leads you into a way higher state of readiness. Equipped, I've taught, that's a success story, really. I mean, it's, you know, the folks on the Hill help us greatly. Army has really buckled down with this. And I got to tell you, in the last couple of weeks, we worked through some real tough times. And where we were talking about $24 billion necessary on the other side of the 13 a time frame at the end of the POM, $24 billion was the hole that we still had stuck out there. Today we think it's $10 billion. Now you think about what we've come through, and all of that stuff is, most of it's being delivered in 08 and 09. So we're not where we want to be, and everybody's still, you know, a little bit apprehensive, you know, the trust factor, we're having to overcome that, but I'm telling you, it's being delivered right now. And I have great expectations for this. And then predictable. What can we tell our soldiers? Yeah, I'll tell you what we tell them, and many of you have heard me tell the soldiers this. What can be expected of you is to go when the governor or the nation or the president calls you. That's what you should be prepared for. The piece about 1 in 6, you know, made my hair stand up on end every time I heard it. You know, 3 years in, we were looking at having to go back over that threshold again, remobilize people, yet folks were still talking about, well, you're only going to go 1 year out of six. And they were going 18 months, not one. So I say, whoa, I must be missing something. It's predictable 1 in 5. 1 year gone, 4 years back. Somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 is a good resourcing model. What happens if you get into the 1 in 6 is that you miss the resourcing year that you depend on for pre-mobilization training. So from that aspect of it, 1 in 6 is no good, you know, for planning purposes. We'd like to think it's 1 in 5. But it may be 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 if the nation calls you, and that's what we tell our soldiers. Okay, so with that, I'll shut up and hopefully I've generated a few questions here off those slides. Thank you. Please.
Secretary of Veterans Affairs Advisory Board for OIF, OEF veterans. And one of the key concerns that we're having right now is outreach. Now, you addressed the pre-mob phase pretty well, but insofar as post-mobilization, could you touch on a little bit the direction you see the Guard going? Because we see a need to reach out and grab those troops as they're going through doing MOBE, and I'd be very interested to see what you got going on that.
Yeah, it's very timely, and I'm going to probably get you ahead of some things that we're spending some time in the Army on right now, and I'm gonna tell you my view of it. You know, when the 134 come back from Minnesota, they got into the yellow ribbon and the reintegration piece that has to start, you know, out here before, you know, mobilization activities back, and the family reintegration and the employer reintegration, all those pieces, okay. And there's some obstacles to overcome. You know, the 60-day hands-off, you know, piece, that is not helpful. But, you know, we've got that was put in place, you know, for the good of the soldier when it was put in place. I mean, there was no intent. I mean, we didn't know what we didn't know about reintegration. And so there are some things out there that we've got to change, and a lot of people are really focused on the counseling aspects of this over and over and over. But let me tell you the number one thing that has popped up on my screen the last 3 weeks. And I was in Iraq 3 weeks ago, and I visited with a unit from my old battalion, hit very hard. And as I dealt with that, I mean, one young soldier with a traumatic brain injury. In fact, I visited with him Monday at BAMSI because I happened to be over that way. And then there was a soldier in that particular incident was killed. And then everybody in it was subjected to the blast, okay? And talking to their dad, his dad, that team had been in their route clearance outfit, combat engineer outfit, route clearance outfit. They had been subjected to two IED blasts in the previous week, same team, okay? Look at them, check on concussion, documented somewhere a return to duty. That's not unusual, I mean, for lots and lots and lots of soldiers. So, I'm not making anything necessarily of that. And, you know, everybody that's played a lot of football or boxed or something like that, you know the deal. Somebody's macho, hey, I'm all right, put me back in, it made me mad, and so forth and so on. What got me, though, was as we were looking at that, what do we owe these soldiers, and how do we do this? And what we owe these soldiers, I think, is making sure that we look at them just right when they come off that plane or wherever and they get ready for this demobilization and reintegration activities. I mean, the worst of the circumstances is concussion, MTBI, TBI, PTSD. I don't think we got documented right. And we've got teams now, what we've charged, in fact, this guy back here is charged with it. We've got teams in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at the boom, we ought to have all that. I think we're getting it, and I think it's going in the medical side, okay? But we ought to be getting it so that when the soldiers get off, it's not the obvious brain injury, it's the ones that aren't obvious. And rather than having the stigma of those folks years from now having to come forward to someplace, I think the Army National Guard owns the secret to this. In every state, you have a head injury council. I know this because my sister ran one for many, many years in Missouri. She schooled me on all this. So when we look at the concussion, you know, what we ought to have is that documentation of when and who was with them. You know, by the way, if there's fatalities or whatever, you know, you ought to have all that in an executive summary because it'll tip you off maybe if there's PTSD somewhere down the line too. But the effects from multiple concussive activities, and no one knows exactly how that is and affects different people different ways, but we ought to have it documented exactly. So when they come forward up here, here comes whatever this cohort's called, you know, and you don't give them an opportunity. You stand in this line. You know, and they look at you, and they say, here's, and, you know, the counseling piece of that starts, so forth and so on. But 5 days, 5 months, 5 years, 15 years, guess what? They still belong to that state out there someplace. And so we ought to have all that identified for them. I mean, it ought to have it all flagged, every bit of it handled the right way, so that we pay attention to that. And we can counsel them, we can get them to the right places. It's not all Defense Department stuff either. And so we're going to attempt to bring all the interagency pieces online at the home station, documenting that at the boom out there and following that with the soldiers back. Now, that's my primary consideration today. States are all over this reintegration thing. Minnesota's just done a wonderful job. Congressman Klein got in behind it. You know, there's money put up against this, and trust me, the states do a wonderful job with this. Well, what happens with the active component soldiers that get off duty, you know, that get out after 5 or 6 years, and where do they go? And, oh, by the way, where's their records and who worries about them? And I'm telling you, the state's going to catch them anyway. And so we need to get that set up right now. And this thing, this program that the Army is running on the Integrated Family Action Plan is huge. It is enormous in the potential. We will have 250 permanent family assistance centers spread across the United States to handle these kinds of things. And they ought to be the outreach to every youngster that has a problem, or oldster, you know, as it may be at that time. But we also ought to have it all documented down in black and white. where they were, who they were, you know, when it happened. We don't have that right now. Okay?
Could I ask that when people ask questions, you just state your name and identify your affiliation? Okay. I'd like to ask. Oh, all right. There in the back.
Stand up.
If you like.
Bill Taylor from CSIS. Sir, that was a great presentation. I spent 27 years in the Army, came here at CSIS. I've had 27 years here. The thing that I'm proud of more than anything else since I've been here is that the Youth Challenge Program was born right here in 1991-92.
That's a big deal.
It was a study co-chaired by Republican Senator John McCain and Democrat Congressman Dave McCurdy from Oklahoma. And we worked with Herb Temple. We worked with Dan Donahue. We got it off the ground, rocking and rolling. You mentioned it. I want to ask a question. Why is it only up and running in 20, is it 26 states?
30 now. It's going.
I think that's the answer to my question.
Well, part of that,
the
you know.
The website doesn't say 30 yet.
Well, it will, though.
Okay. All right.
Thanks for your great work, sir. This is, and I know you were behind that. This, you know, when you first put it in and you built it, and because there's a matching chair to that, I believe it was 75-25, and later that becomes 60-40. 75 federal, 25 state at the time, and I believe it's 60-40 now. And I will tell you that there was, you know, in the crunch in the states as they went through this process, you know, the pendulum swing, there were states that pared out of this or pared it way down. But I will tell you, you know, if you go around the country and it doesn't matter really who you meet with, they'll say there's a whole bunch of issues out there. But there are three of them that really have to be dealt with, I think, in the next 10 years. At least in the sessions that I've gone through, it's come out every time. Energy. National health care in some shape, form, or fashion, and the left behind disadvantaged, dropped-out youth of the nation. Those are the big three that come up time after time. Now, the only one we can really affect happens to be, you know, the left behind disadvantaged youth of the nation. And taking the program that you all put in place and saying, how can I take that to the next level? That's where those three circles are drawn. And I'm telling you, we're going to take this next one into the high school bracket. Because what you got youngsters that don't have to join, okay, that you're dealing with over on this end, and it's just remarkable how well they've done. Then you got youngsters that join for the GED activities, but they're older. They average about 23 and a half, somewhere around there. What we're now after are those that are 17, 18 years old, the cream of the crop, that have dropped out, completed their sophomore year in school. What we want to do is we want to enlist those dropouts and send them to basic training. People say you can't do it. You can if you own the school and you had it accredited. So we'd like to own the school, see, under the split option plan. Who else has statutory authority to do that? The split option program. So it's taking advantage of a whole bunch of things we have. But I will tell you there are and I won't tell you who they are, but the two of the biggest corporate activities in the country have already lined up behind us and said, we'll do whatever you want to do with that program. And so thanks for all your work on that. But that's exactly the way you secure. When these bonuses, look, I mean, $20,000 bonus, you know, to get in $15,000, $20,000 retention, the perceived value of folks' service right now is pretty high because of the way people, you know, take to them when they come back. But it's also the fact that you're paying them a bonus that's halfway indicative of their service and their value. What happens when that thing goes south entirely? And I think the way to secure the youngsters, you know, of this nation is through these programs. And we've got the tools in place to do it because of what you started years ago. That make sense?
General Vaughn, I've got a question on the Homeland Security front. For years now, there's been a lot of debate about the role of the National Guard in particular in the homeland. And it seems to me, you know, you have the way we're handling it today, which is sort of dual mission. You have some folks who say the National Guard ought to be exclusively a homeland force. You have other folks like me and others at CSIS who have argued the Guard could do both. You could both pay more attention to civil support missions, but also keep your overseas role. And then you've got the Commission on Guard and Reserves, who has come out and has certainly leaned at least a little bit farther in the direction of saying don't take away the overseas mission, but you may have to have some specialization in the Guard that's exclusively focused on civil support. Where do you see that debate going, and what do you think is the right answer for the National Guard and for the nation?
Yeah, I'm going to give you what they tell you not to do and give you in testimony, give you my personal view of this. And I feel very strongly about it. Number one is I don't feel that like the nation can afford folks that just do witness. I just don't think there's enough money out there. I mean, the folks that say, oh, yeah, the Guard's going to run over here and do something else, and it's not going to really do the warfight piece, are out of their minds. I mean, we've got 370 years of history. It's not going to change. If you turn around to those flags and those combat units and you look at what's really behind that and the ability to build that force, you know, and the culture that's behind that, and you say, I'm going to shift that some other place, I don't think the country's got that kind of money. I'm just telling you that is billions of dollars that we can't even. And someone will say, well, we got to give the Guard more combat service and combat service support so they can deal with this mission. Give me a break. We already got more combat service and service support than anybody else does. That's because we're so big. Our combat service and service support is as big as the Army Reserve. Why do we want more? No one's got a crystal ball that puts it out here and says this is the kind of force that you got to have for whatever we're faced with. Nobody. And every time we get involved in a big one, and I've been involved in every big one for the last 25 years, and it takes a lot of soldiers to secure stuff. And for the most part, the folks that you find that are very helpful to this, you know, happen to be usually combat arms folks and infantry guys, you know, with good comms, good transportation capabilities, and it fits. Now, I think with the Pinero Commission report, I think it's really a brilliant document. I think it invites a lot of discussion. You know, there's not a lot. There's some things folks are looking for, a lot of black and white, you know, things in that document, and I don't know necessarily that it's up there. It invites a bigger conversation. You say, well, you have this mission. Yes, we have that mission. It goes as far back as you can go. And, oh, by the way, there's a political reality of this that goes with this mission. And it goes along the lines of which party, you know, is in place, what party the governor comes from. We're going to step over the top of him. No, not likely, maybe. How are we going to deal with this? It's bigger than what the governor can get his hands around, really. I think that our strength lays as an organization in this ability to respond quickly on a decentralized basis anywhere within this country in a matter of hours. Not in huge numbers. I think that's an active component role. And people are going to say, Vaughn, where are you going on this? I'm telling you, there's some folks that think we can take the Army National Guard, say 5,000 or 6,000 folks, and go 8 hours across the country someplace. Why would we want to do that? I mean, to get 5,000 folks, you have to go to 100 units to get them and then cross-level them. And we're betting, and we're going to set the bar that high for us to do that. And I'll tell you something. If something happens in Kennett, Missouri, you know, within hours, there's folks going in there. You know, whether it be from Dexter, Pop, they don't even have to get ordered down there. They're headed that way already. And they'll be there at 65% of the units, and the people just keep piling on to everybody says, that's enough. You know, they'll do that. If it's a federal response, then what we ought to do is go to the post camp and station someplace where the AC forces are and put them on a plane and get them there in a hurry from one location. You know what the dilemma is? Who do they work for? Give me a break. I mean, I've heard this and heard this and heard this. If I was an adjutant general, someone out there, it's you know, it's a slam. Say, well, Vaughn, you're not capable of commanding AC forces or whatever, because that goes back in our heritage someplace when somebody wrote something in the law that, no, I'm a active soldier, so I can't be commanded by a Guard soldier. That's ludicrous. It really is. And we ought to be piling in on top of that governor. Or if it's regional, and if the president federalizes everything, that's very simple. Man, it's all federal. But the dilemma is, if it's not federalized, you know, everybody just needs to come to the dance real quick and let's work out this command and control thing, because that governor's still going to be in charge. Now, I've been through New York, right? You go through Katrina, Rita, the towers. Tell me, did we do anything? Those were huge events. Folks will say the guard's got to have this mission because it's there, right? We already have some niche capabilities in the CSTs, and there's some other things. You know, I tell you, my view of it is we probably ought to take a great deal and put a great deal of capability in terms of chem, bio, and nuke, you know, and some decon kind of capabilities out there. Get an additional skill identifier for a whole bunch of soldiers and train them. Train them. I mean, if the answer is you need 20,000 people in decon business, then we all train 20,000 folks. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of units they're in, just so they're out there, right? Folks will say, well, you got to do this because it's number one homeland defense mission, and so you take your structure and go do this. Is it an offensive mission or is it a recovery mission? Because it's offensive, it appears to me that it's all intel, and there's a whole bunch of other interagency folks involved in this. I mean, it's kind of like New York. I mean, when Christine was talking about, you know, I was the Dom. I was the Deputy Doms at the time. And, okay, so, bang, New York happens. Instantly, everybody's talking about, oh, we got to get these up there, and we got to get this force up there. And I said, why? I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, New York's got four divisions worth of shooters up there. They got more people armed than we ever thought about. That we can get in there for the next two or three, and you can't even get them in on the ground because turf is a problem. And so, you know, I tell you, the Guard, it's the homeland is always going to be the number one mission. There is no question about that. No question about it. We're going to go to it. But the Guard's also going to always have a foot in the combat side of this. And those that don't like that are those folks that will subscribe to a bigger standing army, a bigger Federal Reserve, and a draft. I mean, there are folks that still talk about draft today. And I'm telling you, the thing that keeps the United States from having to go to a draft is the fact that the Guard is standing there right in the middle of this thing, producing lots of soldiers. The Army Reserve has done this too. I mean, they've done wonderful. And it's not about a Guard or Reserve thing. I would ask you if they're tempting you or tempting some folks to make the argument about, you know, when they talk about providing combat, you know, to the Reserve and CSCSS to the Guard because of the homeland mission, are they really getting it? Maybe we just need to have one Federal Reserve. I mean, I'm not here to discuss that, but I'm telling you, once someone starts down that lane, that discussion is going to come up. You're just not going to be able to take this combat piece away from the Guard, nor should you ever do something like that. Okay, those are my feelings on it.
On various scenarios that might exist in regions, whether they be hit by a natural disaster or a terrorist, man-made disaster, to what extent has there been thinking about a really comprehensive field training exercise? Not just, you know, command and control, headquarters, company kind of thing, but where you would lay out a scenario for NORTHCOM, active Guard and Reserve forces in a region of the country, Katrina-esque, that would test various management models, 3210, governor in charge, governor not in charge, federalized, not federalized, and run them in a real FTX in maybe several, over a year or two period of time, so that we could get some information and deal with each other being active Guard and Reserve, governors, president, and come up with what made most sense.
It's a great question from this aspect. My view of it is that they're running the exercises, but they but they misshot the exercises, because the exercises always start almost from inevitably from the very first. You throw all the options out and it goes right to a federal response. And so what happens is you don't exercise all the pieces. You don't exercise like we play every day. And, hey, we're all into this. For if there's a federal response required, we all want to make that happen. That is no kidding. We all know what that implies. But we run right past. I mean, all the scenarios start to the folks in the Guard. I mean, most Guard folks would just kind of smile, especially the tags and the state, you know, interagency folks, because they'll say, uh-huh, you show up on day 22 and you're ready to play. Is that there are exercises out there. By the way, you know, we have a wonderful urban training center going. Anybody from Indiana? Anybody know anything about Muscatatuck? You ought to keep your – oh, by the way, let me tell you, one of the things, and this is kind of shopping around here, Muscatatuck, the place that we would like to run the first high school is in Muscatatuck. And one of the reasons why is all these folks would also be role players in the urban training center. You ever hear something called a hostage situation or school shooters or all that? Try to run one of those events out here in one of these colleges or high schools. That'd be a high adventure. I mean, those parents go, right? We're talking about folks that are actually soldiers, having gone to basic training, role model, role players, and having an actual live capability to run that kind of a scenario inside an urban training center. Now, getting back to it, but I think I've probably answered your question. It really, they need to restart this thing back here and play it real, just like it's going to be played, and really get serious about the command and control. No, we haven't done it at the level. In my view, we haven't done it at that particular level that should be done. And, you know, there's I've told Steve Blum two or three times, I said, you know, I know we're hung up on this federal model, you know, about folks responding to NORTHCOM. What we ought to be doing, in my view, in the Guard, is taking son or daughter of EMAC. Okay? You got the state active duty response. You got the EMAC. Now, what's the son or daughter of EMAC, which is what we ran out of the Army National Guard Operations Center? Several of these people right here did. Right here is the team that sent the 50,000 Army soldiers downrange. This is it, okay? We did it simply because that organization that was over there dealt with all those pieces all the time. Not that we were practiced at that particular thing, but you say move soldiers and move them quickly down there. All the pipelines were there to do it. But we ought to have that in the playbook. And my view is you take three of these divisions, you know, and give them that particular mission and regionalize the response by EMAC, okay? And then you're ready for the next higher level, which is the federal response. So there's a building block in here. State active duty, EMAC. EMAC is you know, it's all organizations within the state. In the assistance compact, it doesn't have to necessarily be military. Everybody thinks it's military right off the bat, but you're not smart enough. No one's smart enough to really see all the different pieces. I mean, you'll have okay, if I'm Louisiana and I know right off the bat I don't have enough aviation, I've already made an EMAC contact with Alabama for some more aviation. Same thing all the way across. But no one could have seen sending 45 or 50,000 soldiers, you know, and what that looked like and what the requirements were. So when we got into it real quick, and Jerry Ketchum sitting right here. Jerry was my operation. Hold your hand up, Jerry. Jerry was my operations officer for that particular event. And I'll tell you right off the bat, Jerry, I mean, we've been in like one day. Get a division headquarters into both Mississippi and Alabama to sort out what the requirements are. We can't see the requirements from back, you know, where we were. We know that they wanted 40,000 soldiers. And we're going to give them 40,000 soldiers until they stop. You know, we're going to give them people to guard things. Is that the right mix? They're so swarmed on the other end, which are going to be in any event, that they can't pay attention to the RSOI or the requirements process. So you got to have somebody driving that back the other way. Well, why don't we do that on a habitual relationship? That's what we ought to be doing. In my view, we ought to be doing that in the Guard. We ought to bring son or daughter of EMAC to the square root to bear on this problem. And then if you've got to go, and then if it happens to go building block wise to federal, now it may, you know, flash bang may go to federal right off the bat, just like that. But we need to replay those scenarios all the way through.
PJ.
PJ Crowley from the Center for American Progress. General, two questions. One, and pick an arbitrary figure, if an active duty soldier costs a dollar and a traditional guardsman might have cost 65 cents, now when you go from a strategic reserve to an operational force, does the cost of the standing guardsman increase, and if so, you know, how? And then a second question, picking up on where you just left off, you've got the Guard Bureau, you've got NORTHCOM, and you've got what I would describe as not necessarily guard structure in the middle. Should the Army Guard be our North? And then you're running the planning process. On one side of your brain, you could respond as a, you know, under state authority, and on the other side of your brain, it's the same response under the federal authority, but now you own the planning function because your chances are you're going to be the first force on the ground anyway.
PJ, my view of that is the Army National Guard should never be our North. It should be, the Army National Guard should be within the Army and the Air National Guard within the Air. Now, is the question, should NGB be our North? It may be a better question. I mean, I will tell you that that will break lots of rice bowls all over. You know, and I hope this is not going anyplace. I mean, That is a question that probably, because, you know, when you look at the two directors, myself and McKinley, and in the Panera report, it had something about this dual chain. That's the way we operate now. I don't know where anybody understands that or not. All the things that Gordon Stump, who's a good friend of mine, says, you know, that NGB does, we do. We do force structure. We handle the entire budget, you know, for the Army National Guard. We do all those pieces. So should there be a dual chain between the chief of the Bureau and the chief staff of the Army? Right now, with 2 3-stars, Blum being a 3-star, me being a 3-star, there's no doubt who the boss is, chief staff of the Army. 4 outranks 3 every time, right? Now, but it also, see, it had flames on it because he said the director of the Air Guard and Army Guard ought to be commanders, just like the reserve, the Federal Reserve commanders. I don't agree with that. I mean, everybody knows what the lanes of the two directors are, and they simply ought to be directors. I mean, you're never going to have command and control, nor should you, nor do I care about having that over the states. I mean, statutorily, just none other than the Constitution is what's being challenged by that comment. Other than maybe I'd command and control 1,800 that are in my headquarters out there. As it is, we have every piece. We are really the Army's largest MACOM. I mean, folks will say, "Oh, you're not a MACOM because you don't have budget authority. You don't have this. We handle everything." Okay, we don't own the money, which makes it even harder because we got to go head to head with the Army all the time on all this. But we're an enormous MACOM in the Army National Guard. But I see the two directors as being simply directors. I mean, there's this command and control thing is kind of a red herring. I mean, command of the commander is kind of a red herring. And I'm good with a dual relationship. A lot of folks around this country have dual relationships. I don't see that as, and that's the way it works now, frankly, between myself and General Blum, General Casey. Now, what happens when you fully implement the rest of the story about NGB and the direct relationship with the SecDef through the chairman? And, oh, by the way, looking out the corner of your eye at NORTHCOM over, you know, on this side. You said our North. I would say the bigger issue is NGB NORTHCOM, I believe. Didn't you say our North? Yeah, I'm good with our North being like it is. But you see, if you ever take the Army out from underneath, the Army Guard out from underneath the Army, I think you made a real mistake. I mean, that's exactly where this force needs to be. And does that help on that one? Okay, let me get on the next questions, the cost. In the Army Guard and Army Reserve, among the reserve components, are manned at the lowest level of full-time support as any of the reserve components. We're big organizations, though. I mean, so if you man us, you know, full-time support-wise at a higher level, it costs some money. I've heard all the arguments, and I've seen this, and I see what the share of the budget is for us, and I scratch my head every time I hear that, and that's a very simplistic view of, you know, of the pie slice of how much the appropriation you get. Ask yourself this question, and it goes back to this thing I had, the discussion I had on the IDT versus, you know, one day's pay for one day's service. As long as the retirement is out there for the active component, to draw that as fully vested at 20 years and draw it upon 20 years, and the Guard and Reserve retirement is not drawn until out here, and then the medical proviso that goes with that, that amount of money is staggering. And if you ignore that and you say, well, the more money I put in back here, you guys are and gals are getting more and more expensive. Well, maybe true. But if you really want to have a heads up, no kidding, here's the true cost to the nation, you know, and what it costs. And you figure in retirement, the gray era retirement, and you figure in medical care. Now, medical care may come back around a little bit, but Pinero's got this right a little bit. And I, in fact, you know, a good discussion I had with Christine earlier. You know, when we talk about the, what do they call that, where you cross back and forth between the Guard and the continuum service thing. There was some work, I think, done at one time by some folks in Dr. Chu's office at a level, you know, upon, you know, what should really retirement be long term? I mean, because of the cost to the nation, you know, with all the folks that we're paying out here and whatnot. And it's very inflammatory, you know, as, you know, the youngsters are serving day, say, look, I put my life in harm's way. I've been counting on this. This is what the nation told me. I agree with all that. But if you take, for instance, aviators, and I say, for instance, aviators, specifically aviators, and you say you have aviators going back in the active component for their fourth, fifth, and sixth tours, the fallout from that aviation community is going to be, in my view, it's going to be pretty extraordinary because they have not had a chance to get a family started. This is not quite what most of them signed up for. A lot of stress on that force. Now, how can we as a nation not keep them in the harness someplace? And I'm saying that may be the cohort to look at for a 5 or 10 year retirement. Oh, by the way, we ought to do something halfway smart. Let them serve in the Guard or Reserve. In the Army Guard, we got more of the aviation force structure. I mean, most people can draw retirement, go to work for someone else. You know, you can draw retirement out of the Army, and you can't go back in the Army Guard and draw that retirement, right? Because it would tend to make people maybe, you know, get out a little earlier out of the Army. But if that aviation community, if that's going to happen, I think that'd be a great trial model, and that may be something everybody wants to get their hands, somebody wants to get their hands on a little bit. What would be the cost savings to the nation if you had a 5 or a 10 year based on points and days, and you paid that right there and let them stay in the hitch, and then you also made medical care available to them at some kind of reduced rate or whatever. Now look at the potential if you got in a big-time conflict and we had them warehoused. That's one of the reasons that we like aviation so much is we catch the fallout from the active force in aviation. We got great aviators. And we had the most tremendous aviators that anyone had after Vietnam's going to happen again. We got great aviators already. We're going to catch them coming this way. What I think the difference, in cost is huge if you factor in all that. And all you have to do, and don't take my figures for granted because I had a couple of these folks run that out one time. The cost of that cohort that goes all the way through, if you took an 18-year-old, you know, and spent 20 years in, say was in the hard combat arms and had 20 years in at 38 and spent 4 more years and turns around one day and says, hi, I'm 42. It's time to chuck this and go do something else. I've served my country. If you took that cohort and the total number and priced it all the way out, the number in billions will floor you. It will floor you. Okay, I paid this one this year. This Guard soldier over here at 43, I didn't pay. Paid him in the second year, paid him in the third year, paid him in the fourth. You see what I'm saying? You get what I'm saying. You add that up for each soldier. You didn't pay that for this Guard soldier over here. You paid this Guard soldier something else in IDT or kept them around, but they're actually counting against the end strength of the Army or the Army Guard, so it doesn't count, see? It's wiped out. Okay, so if you took the difference There's where the difference is. And that's why this thing about this discussion about, well, we'll have to cut their pay, you know, one day's pay for one day's duty. I don't know, not so quick. If you add that up, you may find out you owe them 5 days and not four. Problem we got is youngsters don't want medical care. You know, they at that, you know, the 18, 19, 20-year-old, and they're not really caught up on retirement because they just can't believe they could live another 30 years, you know. So IDT pay is really pretty good thing. Okay, does that help?
Okay, well, I think actually General Vaughn has an appointment up on the Hill that he's got to get to, and I think we've kept him over time. But if anyone does have one last question, we might be able to convince him to stay, but we are over time. So thank you very much. I do want to just put in a shameless plug for another upcoming event that CSIS is doing that may be of interest to this audience. We will be having a conference, I think, in early April. The exact date is TBD, where we're going to try and bring together a lot of the senior folks involved in the Garden Reserve issues, the Homeland Security issues, to talk about the most prominent recommendations on the Commission on National Guard and Reserve. So we've invited a lot of very senior people, Assistant Secretary McHale, General Renouart, General Blum, Chairman Panaro, and others. So keep your eye out for that. Sort of watch this space. I think it'll be coming up in about a month. Thank you very much, General Baum. We really appreciate it.